Scoville again. Always look forward to it. I've been asked to do some teaching this weekend and perhaps later on in the week on the Christian family. I'm glad to do that. Very interesting that it's significant, I think, and I'll just mention it because it is significant. I teach in many areas, whole lectureships and seminars or whatever you want to call them, all over the United States. And I teach on, of course, on the Holy Spirit, teach on evolution, teach on cults. But I teach more about family than do any other subject. For every session I hold on evolution or cultism or one of these other subjects, I hold three or four seminars on family life. And the interesting thing about that is I have absolutely no academic training whatever in family life. Just thought I'd tell you that. I'm a complete amateur. I had one undergraduate course in psychology, and it wasn't any good. I read a lot of books written from the secular world on it, but I just want you to know that I'm not a psychologist, never claimed to be a psychologist, and I have a family. That'll teach you something. And a wife and four children, and our family works. But there is such a need for this. And I'll say two things about my approach to family life. I'm going to be preaching on the family in the morning hour. I'm not sure what I'm going to do tonight. See how it goes. But two things. Number one, that I'm not a... you're not going to get much psychology. I don't know that much psychology. Modern psychology, if you go to an undergraduate... take an undergraduate course at university or go to a junior college... you're going to hear many of the things which are absolutely opposite of what you're going to hear from me. I just want you to know that I'm right. They're wrong. Well, when my wife started raising our family of four children, Dr. Spock was the big thing. I read Dr. Spock and then read back and through it just as far as I could because I knew that wouldn't work, and it turned out it didn't work. He was wrong. But I knew it back then, and he's since admitted it. The reason that many modern theories... stuff which our kids are getting in high schools even, and which are taught across the board, are based on Freud in one way or another. And Freud based everything he wrote on Darwin. And that's why it doesn't work. I'm very serious about that. You see, there's two problems that... The theory of evolution creates two problems for modern thinking about man in general, family life in particular. Number one is that man is much more complex than the theory of evolution permits him to be. Understand? He's just not that simple. And secondly, man is not as good as the theory of evolution wants him to be. The man has not risen, he has fallen. The common humanist idea is that man is basically good, our children are basically good, and just got to affirm the goodness and go on from there, which doesn't work. Why? Because the Bible teaches that man is a sinner. Don't turn your back on him. He'll destroy himself, his social institutions, and history is on our side. That is, man is not basically good. Man is basically has been corrupted by sin, his own sin, and the sin of others, and he is evil, basically. The heart is not to be trusted. Well, anyway, for those are two basic fallacies. Now, of that approach. Now, the biblical approach is, I think, the right one. It's interesting how God's plan works, if you'll just work it, in the family. Now, I'm not going to teach on everything this morning. I want to teach on one basic principle, which is absolutely fundamental to all thinking about family life, and that is the biblical principle of covenant. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 18 through 24, we read the foundation of the family. Verse 18, God says, it's not good for man to be alone. That's the motive for creating the family. God created the family, created marriage for intimate fellowship. That is, the Bible does not teach that God created the family, the marriage, so that they could produce children. That is secondary. It says God saw that it was not good to be alone. He's certainly right about that, isn't he? And then it says on in the text, it comes down to verse 23, and man said, this is now bone of my bones, flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. For this cause the man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh. And then over in Matthew chapter 19, verses 1 through 8, Jesus harkens back to this and gives his teaching on divorce, in which he states this basic principle, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Now, I'm not here to talk about all the difficulties raised by divorce, which brings me to the second thing I want to say. The first was that I'm not a psychologist. The second one is that I'm not into cure. I'm into prevention. A lot of fellows into cure. There's thousands of people in this community making a living on cure. And I don't know anything about it. If you got a problem, teenager, don't ask me how to get it straightened out, because I probably don't know. I'll tell you something, but it probably won't be worth anything. I don't know anything about, I've never had a problem, teenager. I don't know. Understand? I'm not into cure. I may have a few things to say about it, but that's not my bag. I'm into prevention. As you know, with the family life, the minute when things fall apart, usually there isn't a cure anyway. In family life, things get too broke to mend very quickly. And if we're going to be happy in family life, by we, I mean the church, we've got to be in the business of prevention. One of the great fallacies of the popular mind is that experience is the best teacher. Well, it isn't. Sometimes it's the only teacher, because we're too hard-headed to learn from anything else. But experience is the worst teacher. Often experience is the teacher of last resort. That doesn't make it the best teacher. Two basic reasons why experience is not the best teacher. Number one is the lesson usually comes too late. That's certainly true in family life. And second, experience is not the best teacher because the tuition is too high. Well, I just remember the prodigal son who came home. He learned by experience that, so he started out thinking happiness was daddy in his rearview mirror, and he learned better, but he left his inheritance in the far country. It cost him, understand? It was pretty high tuition to pay for something he could have learned just by listening to his daddy. Did you get my point? Prevention. And so I'm going to teach this lesson with a view to prevention. And that is the lesson of the covenant, what God has joined together. You see, the Bible is very clear about this, that marriage is a covenant. Before we say anything else about the home, about the family, we must say that. We must operate from that. And we must build, to mix my metaphors somewhat, on that foundation, that it's a covenant. Now, the modern view of family is it's a convenience. It's a convenient arrangement. It doesn't work out, well, you can break it and go something else. The modern view of marriage is that it's open-ended. Don't worry too much about who you're going to marry. If it doesn't work out, you can try again. Well, it's not that simple, even from a humanist point of view. But it's not certainly not the biblical point of view. Now, marriage is a covenant. You see, this runs counter to the modern ethic which can be described or summarized in the word selfism. I don't know if you know this or not. I've ever thought about this. I'm sure you have. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. Is that the dominant value today is self. I was in my youngest son's junior high school a few weeks ago. Before, in the morning hours before class started, for some reason, I forgot what it was, and they were on the PA system, they had a song playing, and they played it between, they would interrupt it to make announcements for the day. And the song was, I think it's, is it Whitney Houston's song, The Greatest Love? That sort of become the hymn of this generation, the last two or three years. The greatest love. What is the greatest love? She says, I found the greatest love. It's the love of self. The greatest love is to love yourself. This is a selfist society. And the highest value, the dominant value in our secular society is self. And therefore, number one right, the right that outvotes every other right in this culture, is the right to personal happiness. This comes into in other words, you have a right to your own happiness. You have a right to be happy. Before any other right is talked about, according to our secular society, the right to be happy, that right outvotes every other right. Now, this has come into the church in the version of, well, you know, God wants you happy. And every preacher who's done much marriage counseling has couples come to him who want to break up their marriage, and they say, but we're not happy. God wants us, and they want a preacher who'll say to them, well, that's right, God wants you to be happy. Go ahead and break up the marriage. Why? Because you've got to be happy. Only go around once, you know, and and he'd be happy. And if one preacher doesn't tell them that, they'll go find another one who will tell them that. Well, I'm here to tell you that that is not the biblical standard. That the right to personal happiness, if it does exist at all, does not outvote the covenant. Did you get that? The right to be happy doesn't outvote the covenant. That when all else is gone, the covenant is still there, what God has joined together. Now, that sounds pretty sober and serious, doesn't it? Well, but it has some very practical values. You see, I am convinced that the true joy is found in covenant keeping. Covenant keeping is not the path to misery, it's the path to joy. I don't have to point out to you, do I, that those who are working the other plan aren't very happy. It's not working. That is, those who believe that the greatest right they have is the right to personal happiness aren't very happy. Some isn't working. You wouldn't disagree with that, would you? You see, the paradox in this is, the divine paradox is, that true joy is found in covenant keeping. Now, this has some practical applications. I'll just give you one. I love my wife. I'd rather be at home than anywhere. I'm glad to see you all and be here, but I'm going to be a lot happier when I get home. I can tell you all the reasons I love my wife, Linda. She's a marvelous person. And when I got through telling you, we'd all be snotting and blowing around, just have a high old sentimental time of it, trying to love my wife. But I'll tell you, one of the basic reasons I love my wife is that I got to. I have no choice. Why? Because whether I like her or not, she's mine. Gives you a whole perspective on love. She is mine. And there isn't anything more unhappy than I can imagine to being stuck with somebody that you can't stand. So I love her. Might as well. You see, she and I are both Christians. And in our marriage vows, we said, till death do us part, as a covenant. We believe that very strongly. And so I tell you, it's a great comfort to me. I'm hard to live with. I love having a wife who can't get rid of me. I'm not kidding. It's a great deal of security. I mean, my wife, we've had some problems, like, you know, especially in the younger years, like all young couples did. We have never used the word divorce. We have considered murder on two or three occasions, but we've never considered divorce. Why? We just stuck with each other. See, what I'm trying to teach you is, and I'm sure you understand this already, if you've got a covenant, then you don't, and if you do not have the option of breaking the covenant, what God has joined together, let not man put asunder, what you do is, instead of looking for ways out, you look for ways to make a covenant work, because you got the covenant, whether it works or not. It's a great motive for me. I've seen young couples get divorces, and I'm pretty sure, in many cases, in which I've seen, they could have had a good marriage if they had just stuck it out a little longer and tried a little harder. But they'd had no awareness of the covenant, so they bailed out and spread their misery to other people. It worked. Now, does that make sense to you? The covenant, you see. And it also is very important in the matter of, for instance, I wish I had time to talk about this for a long time. This is one of the great motives for keeping romance in the marriage. Why? Well, if you don't have the option of finding romance outside the marriage, you work very hard to keep it in the one you got. I do. I date my wife. We're lovers. We're sweethearts. And she wrote me a card, gave to me to open on the plane. She writes love cards to me. And I buy her flowers, which is expensive nonsense from my point of view. But we just date. Why? Well, you know, life is a lot... Now, I'm just be very simple. Life is a lot more fun with romance than it is without it, isn't it? Say yes, because it is. And if the only option we got for romance, the only place we're ever going to have it's in our marriage, then we're going to work like everything to keep it in our marriage. And I'm very serious. You see, it depends on your perspective. Another area where this has very practical application is in preparation for marriage. See, we teach our kids, be very careful who you marry. Because when you're married, you're married. Now, I'm very proud of our second daughter. Our oldest daughter is married to a very excellent young man, and he's become another son. And my second daughter was supposed to get married in June, and she broke it up. She called off the engagement. I'm very proud of her. She was engaged to a very fine fella and a very fine Christian, but she just realized that the differences there were too great and that it just was not a good mix. And I think she was right. We were behind the marriage. We would have supported her, but when she made that decision, we felt it was a... You know, often a fellow can be a very fine... You can have two very fine Christian people who shouldn't get married because they're just too different. And the reason she, and I was very proud of her for that. Took a great deal of courage because she loved the guy. And I loved him. Still do. She understands that you don't only marry a person, you marry a kind of person. That you be very... What I'm saying is that if you understand that marriage is a covenant, then you're careful who you marry. Better to be single than married to the wrong person. And she understands that. But you see, your approach, if you speak to the young people here this morning, your approach to marriage, if you take the modern approach, it's going to be a whole different thing than it's going to be than if you take the biblical approach. If you understand it's a covenant, and the covenant is there. If love dies, the covenant is still there. Listen, when 15 years pass and three kids show up and he gets a pot belly and his hair starts to thin out and she gets varicose veins and you're both sitting there under a 3-ton mortgage, you do not have the option at that point to decide you want to be independent. You know, I got to fly. No. That will come, will it not? Say yes, because it will. I laugh at the myth of the modern wedding. And I've conducted a lot of weddings in my day, but there's a whole mythology connected with weddings. You know, we get this fellow in a very high state of emotion, then make him take a vow to stay that way the rest of his life. And there's not very much realistic about a wedding. I wrote a wedding ceremony that really reflects marriage, but nobody is interested in... I've never been able to sell it to anybody yet. I've got it. Anybody wants it, it's... Very interesting wedding ceremony. We have both mothers-in-law in the wedding. They're going to be in the marriage. Might as well be in the wedding. And the bride has her hair up in curlers and has Vicks salve on. The groom has 3-day growth of beard and that old flannel shirt that she is not going to be able to stand after they're married. She's going to see more. Listen. You guys got married. How many of you got married in a tuxedo? You rented it, didn't you? Yeah. That's artificial. I did too. You rented a tux, but that old flannel shirt that stinks to high heaven, that's the marriage. So y'all get married. Look at this little girl throwing rose petals. When's the last time you walked over rose petals? I'd have them throw dirty underwear, you know. And I'd have a baby cry through the whole wedding. And then when it was over, I'd charge the groom $400 I didn't tell him about. Anyway, I got some other ideas. But we have these wedding myths. Here's one of them. Well, you know, if they love each other, they'll work it out. Oh, yeah? I've seen couples who loved each other before, during, and after the divorce. Love was not the problem. They just didn't know how to make it work. The Christian version of that is, well, they can always pray about it, you know. If they're devout, that'll make the marriage work. See, there's this myth that, you know, here in the church, all our marriages are great. Out there in the world, their marriages are all loony. That's not true. Marriages, on the average, just about as unhappy in the church as they are out there. See, being baptized into the blood of Jesus, the blood of Jesus washes away sin. It does not wash away ignorance. And if you don't have the makings to be a mate, then becoming a Christian gives you a reason to become that kind of person. It does not automatically make you that kind of person. Well, so we think in terms of preparation because we're entering into a covenant. And we figure out ways to make it work. You realize, I teach ancient history, so you can believe me on this. This arrangement we have for getting married, where we... get married because we're in love. See, we find somebody we like. And I did this. I'm not against it. This is the way we do it. Find somebody you love, you date, you decide you can't live without each other, and then you get married. Why did they get married? Well, because they loved each other. Sounds very simple to us, doesn't it? You realize that that's a very recent arrangement in human history that isn't working very well. The plan that is... That men have used, whether it's right or wrong, the plan that men have used for most of the history of the world in most places, and it's still true in most places today, is that you get married and then you learn to love each other because you're married. Reverse that. Somebody else picks out your mate. See, most civilizations have realized that a young couple don't know enough to pick a mate. And so the larger family will pick the mate. Sometimes the whole community gets involved in it. And then they create a marriage for all kinds of good practical reasons. Then they say to the couple, look, now that you're married, you learn to love each other. Remember Fiddler on the Roof? That was the whole theme of the musical Fiddler on the Roof. The matchmaker, the village matchmaker, arranged the marriages for the families. She was the broker for the families. And then, but Rav Tevye, his daughters, they want to get married for love. They want to pick their own mate, which is new. He never thought about that idea before. It's wholly new to him. He gets thinking about it, and he talks to his wife about it. And one of my favorite songs in the Fiddler on the Roof is, Do You Love Me? Because he gets to think about his own marriage. And he says to his wife, Do you love me? She says, What do you mean, do I love you? Do you love me? I've had your kids. I've fixed your meals. I've washed your clothes. I know, he said, but do you love me? And so we got married 25 years ago. We met on our wedding day. They said you'd learn to love each other, and they hadn't talked about it since. And since his daughters raised the question, he said, I want to talk about it. They said we'd learn to love each other. Do you love me? And she hadn't thought about it either. And so she says, well, I guess I love you. He responds, well, I guess I love you too. And the last phrase in the song is, it doesn't change a thing, but after 25 years, it's nice to know. Falling in love. I got a book I'm going to write. When I write my book on family life, it's going to be called, the title is Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Family. I got a great title. I need a book to stick on the end of the title, and I'm in business. But that's going to be the title, Ancient Wisdom for the Modern Family. And one bit of ancient wisdom I'm going to write about when I get time to write it is the art of falling in love after the marriage. See, most people have done it that way for most of the history of the world. And marriage is not a matter of falling in love and then living off that surge the rest of your life. In a good marriage, you fall in love over and over. If marriage is going to work, you have to fall in love every so often. My wife and I fall in love every so often. We always know when it's time. It's great fun. And the art of falling in love. See, any fool can fall in love before the wedding. And most fools do. You can do that by accident. You don't have to know anything or do anything or be anything to fall in love before the wedding. But falling in love after the wedding, that's the trick. And that's the art. Wish I had time to talk more about that. But the covenant calls for a strong act of faith. You see, getting back to where I started about selfism, covenant keeping runs absolutely counter to the modern value of selfism. You see, those two things cannot live under the same roof. A person who lives for themselves, who believes that their highest duty is to themselves, who thinks that their highest right, their dominating right, is the right for personal happiness. Not only would that person not be happy. Selfishness is not the road to happiness. God didn't make us that way. But that person's marriage won't work very well. Why? Because covenant keeping requires otherness. The very genius of covenant keeping requires otherness. That is, if the covenant that my wife and I entered into with God is going to work, then I must not be in the business of making sure I get all my itches scratched and all my needs met and everything I get won out of it and all my rights satisfied. I must make my concern her happiness. Otherwise, it isn't going to work. You see, if you're... And by the way, we're raising a generation of very selfish people. I don't mean selfish in the petty sense, and I'm not criticizing people who are evil. I am primarily. What I'm doing is I'm sympathizing with victims. We get kids. We get a good cross-section of young people in every year at Florida Christian College. And these kids are victims. Now, what they are is they're self-centered brats. It's very hard to see. Time was when we, in Bible colleges, we had motivated kids and all we had to do was teach them. Then that died out, and we went through an age where we had to motivate them so we could teach them. And now we've got to convert them so we can motivate them so we can teach them. About half of our students every year, we have to convert them to the Christian faith, to the Christian religion, before we can even begin to train them for a leadership ministry in the church. And one of the things, one of their many problems is that they've been raised on this Whitney Houston nonsense, that the greatest love is the love of self. And they come in there being trained, being conditioned, and they're victims, again, I'm not putting them down in that sense, that they're there, they live for themselves. And if they like it, it's good. If they don't like it, it's bad. If it feels good, it's all right. If it doesn't feel good, it's bad. If it promotes their private kingdom, it's good. And if it doesn't, it's bad. And it's really hard to teach these kids a sense of sight. So one of the first things we do is have a faith promise rally, missions rally, teach them to start giving and caring about somebody. It's very hard for a young person. Listen, it's very hard for a young person raised in today's culture to care anything about anybody but themselves. They have to work at it, and I sympathize with that. And a lot of them, their parents made them that way. I wish I had time. When I talk about family life seminars, my basic principle in raising children is you raise them so you can like them. Now, most parents don't like their kids. I've met their kids. I don't like them either. Nobody likes an obnoxious, self-centered little snot, even if it's yours. You'll find a reason to be away from them every chance you get. And if you think I'm making this up, you talk to any school teacher, especially in the younger years. You're coming to first and second and third grade. Well, where do they get all this? Well, you see, a self-centered brat who's little and is never turned around will just grow up to be a large self-centered brat. And one of the reasons a lot of marriages are failing today is because when one self-centered brat marries another, it isn't going to work. You think I'm being flippant or unkind? I'm not. I'm not making this up. This is what's going on. Self-centered people marry each other, and there'll be no covenant keeping in that situation. Covenant keeping, to repeat myself, requires the other approach, the otherness approach to life. You understand? That my job in my marriage is to see that my wife is happy. And the grand mystery in this is, it's more blessed to give than to receive. See, this is the great psychological fallacy, and I'm going to mention this in the morning worship, of the modern hatred of children. Our culture hates children. And the increasing value is childlessness. Why? Well, children. See, why? You know it's true. This is growing every year. This is an exploding value. It's expanding. I mean, value in our culture. That children are really a nuisance. And the smaller the family, the better. And a lot of being written today on the value of childlessness. Well, children take a lot of your time, don't they? Take a lot of your money. I've had teenagers. For several years, I had three. I got two teenagers now. For several years, I've had three. Not the same three, but three at one time. Having three teenagers at home will teach you something. It's God's perfect plan for humility and bankruptcy. Not necessarily in that order. I've said a number of times, I could be driving a nice car just for what I've got in contact lenses and tennis shoes alone. Those two things. But you see, the fallacy in that is, see, having children, if we're going to do a good job of having children, raising children, we cannot be oversold on ourselves. Children will require a lot of otherness. And for that reason, the many modern Americans don't want children. But you see, the sad thing is, they think, well, you know, I'll be happier if I don't have to give up so much of myself. If I can keep my freedom, I'll be happier. Children destroy your own personal freedom, don't they? They sure make it hard to be free to do whatever you want to do, whenever you want to do it. Is it bringing them joy? No. See, God, we're made in the image of God, and for some reason, God created us. We know the reason, because he wants a family. And joy is in children and giving. How shall I illustrate this? My kids have kept me broke. My oldest son has asthma, very expensive sickness. And my daughter's kids have always been in everything. I've bought cheerleading outfits and soccer shoes, and the bills go up. You've been there. In fact, my teenagers, for years, when they'd say, "Hi, Daddy," I'd just reach in my pocket and get my billfold. Like, you know, Pavlov's dogs, I just automatically respond, "Hi, Daddy," I'd say, "How much?" And I went broke having teenagers. Do I look unhappy? when they needed money for all this stuff, they didn't go to my neighbor, ask him why. He's not their daddy. They asked me. I'm the one who has to pay, right? Wrong. I'm not the one who has to pay. I'm the one who gets to pay. I get to go broke, and that's exactly what I mean. Why? Well, you see, the same ones who take all my money, they call me daddy, and they love me, and they're the joy of my life. And I can't imagine not having them. I belong to them. They belong to me. I may be broke. I'll never be lonely. And I got a lot of good memories, and I got some good friends. You see my point? And that outvote, and I'd rather have that than some kind of phony baloney freedom that I would have had if I hadn't had those kids. That's the way God made us, you know. You see, the joy in a marriage is not in making yourself happy. The joy comes from making your mate happy. And that makes the covenant work. And it isn't going to work any other way. Is this making sense to you? Basic principles. Well, the last thing I want to say about covenant keeping is that one of the reasons that modern marriages are in trouble is that covenant keeping requires that we be not simply objects, not simply sex objects, not simply sweethearts, but that we be people. People. One of the reasons that a lot of I see marriages fail is because you don't have two people married to each other. You got two something else married to each other. You take so many people today in our culture, which is increasingly becoming a pagan culture. I see young men get married, and there's nothing to them. They have no religious faith. They have no their education is nil. They don't know very much. So you don't believe anything, don't know anything. Their whole world can be summed up in a six-pack and Friday night's football game. They have never given themselves anything higher than themselves. They don't understand a television show if it's above Laverne and Shirley. And they marry a girl whose head is just as empty as theirs, without value. I mean, nothing between their ears but room for rent. And you got two bodies get married, and it doesn't work. Why? Because there's no people there. I've been married 26 years to a wonderful person. I respect her as a person. She's my lover, but she's a person. She can live with a person. Why? Well, she knows something. She's not stupid. And she has a great faith. She has a personality. She has something to her. Is this making sense? I mean, our modern civilization is creating people who aren't anything. There's not even enough there to get mad at. You can't even get disgusted. You can't even bawl them out because you can't get anything to get a hold of. They're just there, taking up space, wasting part of God's creation. And how can these people have a good marriage? And so the covenant requires that we be people. If you're going to marry somebody, I tell the boys down at school, I get the boys together when the girls aren't listening, and I say to the boys, look, she may have a cute little shape and have pretty eyes, and maybe she can even sing, but if she's an airhead, stay single. And I get the girls together and tell them the same thing. I say, he's a stud. He looks great. But there's not enough of him to, I mean, he didn't amount to anything, never going to amount to anything. Stay single or find somebody else. I do that. Why? You see, so many people today are everything on the outside and nothing on the inside. And I wish I were making that up, but I'm not. So I say to the young people, because I'm into prevention, not cure, when you marry somebody, make sure that's a person. There's something there to live with. If you're gonna get up every morning and look at that person, and if you're going to build a life together and make mortgage payments together and take kids to the dentist together and work things out together and try to have a meaning for your life together, you got to have something to work with. Don't start with nothing. And there's a lot of nothing walking around today. I'm not talking about just not having a Christian faith. I'm not talking about having anything. And that sounds very negative and critical, and I don't mean it to be that way. But what I'm trying to say is, do not enter into a covenant with somebody like that. Make sure it's a person. See, we today, our culture relies so much on external appearance. so much looks so good on the outside, and is so empty in the middle, on the inside. And so many people look so good on the outside, and are so empty on the inside. Don't marry somebody like that. The covenant. Well, let me take a question. I've got a couple of minutes left. I don't want to go over time. This is sound kind of negative, and I don't mean it that way. Yes. That's right.
And I think we lack a lot of Christian counselors, not maybe Christian counselors, you know what I'm saying, but trained Christian counselors.
That's exactly right. And that's one of the reasons why I spend so much time over here holding these seminars, is because I have most of what I teach is what I call the secrets and skills of making it work. How do you make it work? You're right. All I've said this morning, I point out the necessity of making it work, the principles involved. But then the next step is precisely what you're suggesting. It's how do you make it work on a day-by-day basis? What do you say to the kids? What do you say to your wife? And that's what it's exactly what we need. And the information's there. A lot of good books are written on the subject. You know, if you go back in the 1950s, 1955, say, 1960, if you went to a Bible bookstore and tried to find a book on the Christian home, there were only three books there, and two of them weren't any good. And you go to a Bible bookstore now, there's a whole section on the Christian family, and most of it's pretty good stuff. Some excellent books written. A lot of it has some bad theology, and some of it's kind of silly. But there's a lot of good stuff written because we've had to. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about. I appreciate your pointing that out. Anyone else? Yes. Yes. Talk to somebody else. I didn't mean to sound snotty. Here's what I mean by that. That's a whole other area. It's a very vital area. It's a growing area. And there's a lot of people who really have a lot to say about that. But I'm not one of them. I don't know anything. I don't know anything about it. I haven't lived that way. And I have not studied it. I'm very serious, and you have a very good question. I just don't have you'd ask it to the wrong person.
We have a few minutes before the worship service. Let's have a word of prayer before we dismiss the service here.